this for a minute because it links to something else I believe in. It said the nature of friendships, what could be more pure than true friendship? Actually, how we handle close company is anything but simple, and who we choose as our friends, I'm paraphrasing, is not very simple at all. So they talked about the different way we choose our friends. You might think about you and your friends that way. Category one was called prioritized protection. Now, whether you realize it or not, the biggest factor is how you rank your friends. In how you rank your friends is how they rank you. See, if they take your side when push comes to shove and you know they'll take your side, then you rank them higher. So, in other words, however they put you, how high they put you on their totem poles, how high you put them. Then there's a thing called the wingman's revenge. The wingman's revenge, which comes from aeronautics, and it comes from this idea that nearly everybody feels, get ready for this, a little delight when their friend has a misfortune. It's hard to admit it. But the joy is greatest when your friend's dating prospects, if you're single and your friend's dating prospects fall through, oh, man. You could be so, you know, he didn't call, he just turned out to be a liar. You get so much sympathy, but if you're your friend, but you know, inside, she's happy. For two reasons. One, she didn't lose a friend. But the other is there's something about having friends, about friends' misfortune that pleases us. This is hard to believe, eh? Why? It's a good question. Somebody who's trying to lose weight. Your friend is losing weight. They lose weight successfully. They're trimming down. Let's say you were always the skinny one and your friend was the fatty. Right, the chunky, and there they were, and then suddenly they start losing weight, and they're looking more and more, getting down to reasonable size, and then boom, they break their diet, and they start gaining weight again, you know. The skinny friend feels happy, secretly. Even though you love your friend, and you wish nothing more than your friend should just continue with what they're doing. Now, maybe this gets back to, you know, having less competition for mates. Do you know what I mean? Maybe it goes back for that. Maybe, you know, if your friend's not in the competition, that you don't mind so much. Maybe just having somebody beautiful around, you know, maybe not your choice. There are some friends I know, people who only pick friends who are unattractive because they don't want to have competition. You've seen that often enough. And then there are friends that are called, it's kind of like a social allure. You pick people who are at least as attractive, if not more attractive than you, because they could attract others. You see? So that's your other reason for having a friend. You want a pretty friend because your pretty friend attracts people. And by attracting the people, therefore, you get some of those benefits. So there you see why the not-so-attractive person and the very attractive person get together. They're both being fed. The very attractive one keeps to be the ruler of the roost, and the unattractive one gets to get in the roost. You know? Okay, more about friends. Now, I know you're going to be saying to me, wait a minute, when is a cigar a cigar? When are friends just friends? Never. There's always something to it. Yep, that's what we shrinks say. Let's talk about friends with benefits. Nice concept, a concept that was invented sometime over the last 10 years, friends with benefits. It means somebody you have sex with who's a friend, and you have no romantic ties. And it seems like college kids say that hooking up with a friend, hooking up, which means having sex with, enhances their friendship. Having sex with your friend makes you more friends with them. But in a careful study, failed romances caused almost most of the breakups between opposite sex friends. So in other words, even though it was just supposedly friends with benefits, it wound up being romantic anyway, and it wound up interfering with external relationships. Another thing, this is Armand DeMille with you with The Positive Mind. We're talking about friendship and the nature of friendship in case you just tuned in. And the nature of friendships, and this is going to tie into something that you're going to find remarkable. Be sure to stay with us. There's a thing called bully allure. Bully allure. You know, it sounds like the name of a perfume. While those who are agreeable, sympathetic, and compromising make great friends, kids still prefer to chum with those who are coercive. Why is that? Why do kids want to be around kids who are bullies? You know, we keep talking about the poor kids being victims of bullies. Little do you know, the kids are very attracted to the bully. See? Why? Resource control. It's tough to resist the bully who is in control of their resources. So if you get close to the bully, even if you're just bullified by the bully, but you get stay close to the bully, you get close to the bully's resources. See, the bully may have other friends, the bully may have girls, the bully may have parties. If they pick on you at the party, at least you're at the party. And then there's this other thing about friends, which is really funny. I mean, you ever realize you always hurt the one you love the most? Did you ever see that? I mean, how you tend to hurt the very, very person you care for the most? I would say that there is a very strong penchant for punishing your best friends. Yep. Betrayal by someone in your inner circle draws more flack than bad behavior from a stranger because we use penalties to promote this in-group cooperation, but we still betray our friends. We betray them. I mean, who would ever think of sleeping with your boyfriend, your girlfriend's boyfriend, you know, your best friend's boyfriend? Who would think of it? Who would think of doing things like that? We do, because there's an additional little charm to it, an additional little energy to it. You know, it's a little more forbidden. But what they're saying is that also we have a need to punish our friends. Like a little sadomasochistic exchange brings us closer. Hard to gather, right? Hard to believe. Lastly, there's a thing about friends getting old. New friends get old. Sometimes friends get tedious. You know that card date you used to have on Wednesday nights when you'd sit all around playing cards and drinking wine and just, it gets tedious, especially if you've met someone or you've upped your level and you no longer operate at that level. How are you going to keep them down on the farm after they've seen Paris? You know, so let's say you suddenly get a boyfriend. And your boyfriend is somebody who introduces you to another level of consciousness, a depth of communication, a depth of love, a depth of beauty. And you do that, and you see him a couple of nights a week, and then, boom, the other night you go play cards with your friends. And you realize there's such a difference here. I feel like I'm me when I'm doing this other thing. And when I'm with my friends, I feel like just nothing, ordinary. So these are very ordinary, interesting concepts, don't you think? The article is from the current Psychology Today. It's called With Friends Like These. But then I thought about it a little more. How do we choose our friends? And here's what I thought. I thought everybody has a position in your friendships. Who are you? Are you in charge? Are you less in charge? Who's the boss? Five of you get together, three of you get together, two of you get together. Who's the leader? Who's the follower? Who's more likely to take charge? What is the relationship between you and one friend, two friends, three friends, four friends, the nature of your friendship? And here's what I began thinking about. I began thinking about a very old concept called family systems theory. Now, family systems theory relates to you, your current relationships, why you're feeling good being married, not married, your friendships, and your relationship with your family. So it's worth paying attention to. Murray Bowen. Can I take that name in vain? Murray Bowen was a smart man. He studied family systems. According to him, a family is a system in which each member has a role to play and rules to respect. Let's just start with that concept, a family. Each member has role to play and rules to respect. So, one role to play, daddy. Another role to play, mommy. Another role to play, sister, but maybe older sister. Another role to play, younger sister. Another role to play, daddy's favorite. Another role to play, mommy's favorite. Another role to play, youngest kid. Another role to play, troubled child. Another role to play, the supreme child, the one who achieves, the achiever, the I'm proud of you kid. Another role to play, the daddy who comes home drunk. These are all roles, and they're all roles, and each person has a role to play, and when you get the family together, each person collaborates on the role. So if daddy's never home, and let's say he's out working at night, and mommy is there at home, and you have an older son, and the older son and mommy's not too happy with daddy, the family system works like this. Daddy's on the outside, mommy's on the inside. The son goes up and fills in half of mommy's position, and, you know, he's now next to mommy, and he's close to mommy. Therefore, when his father comes home, he has a little antagonistic relationship with his father, slight that it might be. The daughter, meanwhile, misses her daddy, and she becomes close to daddy, and she becomes friends with daddy. And the roles are so prescribed, it keeps a balance. Everybody is the way they are. If mommy and daddy decide to go on a vacation together and leave the kids behind, the kids get shaken up. Because where's my role? What am I supposed to be doing? If the kids leave the home, we have a thing called the empty nest syndrome. The parents don't know what to do because they're missing the system. Now, systems theory accounts for this in a very interesting dynamic way, and let me take it a little further. I used to work with some people from Bellevue who were working with the children of leukemic children, right? And these were couples who had children who had leukemia. One thing you know about a child who has leukemia is the child's going to die. You know the life is going to be relatively short. So these people, these couples, would get together in groups and an individual because this is what they wanted to, the tide they wanted to stem. This is what they found out. Whenever there were two parents who were caring for a child and that child had leukemia and that child died, as soon as that child died, the odds were 90% that the family was going to break up, that the mother and father were going to divorce. Studying that, they gathered together a group of people to say, look, you are the parents, and here's what's happened. Let's have a group and talk about all the feelings, because here's what happened. And it goes right back to systems theory. When you have a sick child, all of your attention is focused on the sick child, and none of the attention is focused on your relationship with each other. So you look at the sick child. So now the sick child is serving a purpose. Because you're so used to not looking at each other and avoiding each other that the sick child stays to be your focus. Even when the kid feels good, you two are worrying about future treatments because you don't know how to talk to each other anymore. And when the child finally dies, you divorce. Because you don't even have a relationship except around this sick child. I used to work at a place in Mineola. It's called the Rehabilitation Institute. And I used to work there because it was during my training as an undergraduate student, as a graduate student. I was placed out there at Mineola in a place called the Rehabilitation Institute. And the Rehabilitation Institute, great place. My job was to do therapy with the children, with the men and women who were placed there, who were mentally disabled, it was called, because they had some kind of problem in their mind. But these were usually young adults. And I would work with them, and I would do some psychotherapy, and I would talk to them, and they would get better. Because I was young, I was energetic, and I was a student. I always look for students like that. In fact, I'm looking for student volunteers who want to work with me on a project, on an administrative project. If anybody knows of a student in psychology or social work, have them get in touch with me at my office. I got some great administrative stuff that'll really help a person who's a student. Anyway, going back to my being a student, being a student, I would help these children, and you would see these young people, 15, 16, 17 years old, who were really whacked out children. They couldn't control themselves. They would get better. And therapy would help them get better and better and better. And as soon as they got better, the parents invariably pulled them out of the program. It was like so predictable. Ed Newhouse, he used to be the man who ran the program at the time, he used to say to me, as soon as you get this child better, the family's going to pull him out of program. Because that's what the families did. Because the family was dependent on the child being, dysfunctional. You have a child who's dysfunctional in your family? Is there a dysfunctional member of your family? Part of you has to figure out, how do you depend on their dysfunctionality? What role are you playing in their dysfunctionality? Do you need it? It's like having an alcoholic husband. Do you need your husband to be alcoholic? Because this way, you feel needed in life. Systems theory says that you can't understand yourself unless you understand yourself in the system, in the very system that you're a part of. And that system includes primarily your first family, your nuclear family, and I know I just can't miss a moment. And in addition to that, there are more factors of it. Okay, so this is Armand DeMille with you, with the Prophet of Mind, talking about Murray Bowen's family systems theory. Now, there are a thing called triangles that exist in families. We mentioned it. Triangulation is when there are three people in a family, or it could be more. And a triangle is set up. And the triangle is, I am close to you, but I don't like you. So triangles. Son is close to mommy, but he thinks daddy treats mommy bad. Triangle. Triangle. Girl is close to daddy, but she thinks mommy treats daddy bad. Triangle. Triangle. You get your older sister or older brother to be part of something against your dad or your mom. Triangle. Triangle at work, an employee who says something offhandedly of dissatisfaction about the employer. Triangulation. Gathering. You see triangulation? If you're a boss, you get rid of the person right away. Triangulation is destructive. But it's there, and it becomes a part of the family. And once you're a triangulator, and you know of yourself as a triangulator, you do what you can to stop being in that role in life. How many of you have been in the role of being a triangulee, right? Which is one-third of the triangle in your life. You've been there? You've been negotiating between two people, trying to make peace between two people, trying to be kind to one, not kind to the other, trying to, peacemakers. Then there's another one called the dysfunction of one spouse. Now, in a family system, if one of the spouses are dysfunctional, like if one of them may be neurotic, hysterical, alcoholic, drug addicted, mom or pop, or at work, just dysfunctional. Now you have a system that's built around that parent's dysfunction, and it's part of your system. And how does that affect you in later life? Imagine if you have a mom who has to be protected from the evil alcoholic dad. What kind of friends do you think you form in later life? What would you do if you found yourself attracted to men who drink heavily? You're part of the system. You're always part of the system. In choosing your friendships, ask yourself this question. What family role do I play in my friendships that I always played as a kid? How do I play the same role in my friendships now as I did as a kid? Where is if I have friends who never call me back, right, who never initiate contact, how was I like that as a child? And you'll see that you repeat the very pattern from childhood in your adult friendship relationships. In fact, very often you reiterate your sibling position. If you're the second son, the second child, the third child, you act just like a third child does. You act like the youngest child. You act like the oldest child, according to whatever your sibling position was. You do what's typical. You know, second children are always rebels. First children are always obedient to the parents. You know, the last child always wants to be treated special because they're the baby. Then there is the emotional cutoff. And that's the act of reducing or cutting off emotional contact with the family as a way of managing the family. When a family is under stress and when something threatens to blow, very often one person in the family says, I'm not going to be a part of this anymore. And they step out of the family. And it's like a raging fire. You remove a piece of the flame. You remove a part of it. But that person now being outside the flame, outside the family, and is emotionally cut off, can become the target of the entire family. They now point at Louis, who doesn't want to come around anymore. Did you talk to Louis? No, he didn't call me back. So now all your attention goes to Louis. Louis, meanwhile, is emotionally cut off, and the only way he could be outside the family is to kill himself as a family member. So you become emotionally cut off. Are you an emotional cut off? You ever done that? You ever do that in a relationship where you suddenly, boom, you throw the switch off and you feel nothing ever again? That's emotional cut off. It comes from learning it as a kid. This is Armand DeMille. Probably much too much information all at once. And maybe we'll have to take your calls and see how you stand with this, you know? Because what we're talking about is called family systems theory. You could learn more about it by going to the internet under family systems theory, learning about your relationship. Maintaining the same pattern of behaviors within a system may lead to a balance, but also to perpetuating its dysfunction. If a husband is depressed and cannot pull himself together, the wife may need to pick up some of the responsibilities, to pick up the slack. The change in roles may maintain the stability of the relationship, but it may also push the family towards a different equilibrium. You know what I mean? It's now mom becomes dad because she's picking up the role. Now, does that work? You got a guy, he's the dad, but he's a non-dad dad. You have a mom who becomes the dad. How does that affect the whole system? So when we think about changes that people make within a family structure, we, the therapists, or I hope we do, we think about what effect is it having on them, the people around them, and what's going to be the counter effect. Because when a family sees that it's losing somebody, it's going to do something. How many of you know of mother-in-laws who broke their legs at their weddings? Oh, it's a common thing. You don't know about that, right? Mother-in-laws. It was my wedding. Mom was walking down the stairs, and she fell and broke her leg. I can tell you, I've heard this story so many times, and the focus of the wedding became mom's broken leg. You know? And it took it completely away from the wedding. The wedding almost never happened. They proceeded, they got mom to the ambulance, and then they went back and they did the ceremony as an afterthought, and it was mom's wedding. Do you think mom consciously said, I think I'll slip and fall and break my leg? But more moms than you can imagine have fallen and broken their legs. For some reason, dads don't fall and break their legs. At those times, you would imagine dad is going to have resistance to his family system being changed as well. But moms do, especially when it's their daughters. They kind of take the stage away, you know. No, it's my wedding, it's not yours. Telephone number here is 212-209-2900. We're talking about family systems, the role you play in your family, and the one that you perpetuate today. We want to see how you perpetuate it. We want to see how you do it with your own family. What role do you play? Possessions in your family, your position in with your friends is identical to your position with your original family. And keep in mind, when you make a change, it upsets everybody. It upsets the people around you because you're part of a system. The family is a machine. with many parts, and you're one of the parts. You can't just step outside of it. Because if you step outside of it, the machine breaks down and calls you back in. And if you become so immune that you could step out and not feel anything, then you've deadened yourself. See, so let's say you know you're part of the family machine, and the family machine is dysfunctional. The family is just a bunch of people who are being nutty. And you say, I'm not going to be a part of it. I'll just step out. How do you step out and stop worrying about what your mother feels, or your father feels, or how they are, or your sisters or your brothers? How do you do it? You go numb. You got to go dead inside. If you could step out with consciousness, you would step out and feel the sadness from leaving them there and knowing all the time that you care. But it's hard to do. The only way to step out is to remove yourself. But if you remove yourself, you remove your heart. And if you remove your heart, you kill yourself a little bit. So you got to step away with consciousness, my friends. And that's not easy to do because you're usually not aware of what you're doing. When one part of the system changes or changes itself, it threatens to break the integrity of the entire system. By one person leaving a family, the entire family threatens to fall apart. So it kind of either makes you dead as if you were never born, or it breaks down and calls you back. And I know many of you know exactly what I'm talking about. So when we get back from our break, which we'll play, and today, I've got some very interesting music for you, Michael. Here's someone, Eric Alabaster, a drummer, who sent us this. We're going to be playing a piece of this for you today. It's very, very, very interesting music, fascinating music. And we're going to be playing a part of that for you today. And again, I request people who are students of psychology who want to learn from hands-on what psychology is about, social work is about, from the inside, not just being sent to a place where you barely do anything. If you have volunteer time and you could volunteer your time and you are a student of psychology, social work, or mental health, please call me, and I have some projects that we're doing right now where we want to have some people around. We had somebody working here who was just great, Priya. And she was fabulous, and she just went back to college, and she left a spot to fill. So we're going to take a short break, and when we come back, we'll take your calls as well. And Michael, I know I'm a little off time, but we'll be back in a couple of minutes. I love talented drummers, and there's such a talent in there, being a drummer myself. Eric Alabaster, Alabaster. Keep your eyes out for this one. Eric Alabaster, the album, Pog Hell and the Sugar. I know, the local love music of Eric Alabaster. And I'll play you a little more of that a little later, something else that he did as well. Some fabulous thing. That one's called Child's Play 2, which I like, but he also does a lot of instrumental stuff. He should be sure to get an album to Michael G. Haskins. You'd love this stuff, Michael. Our telephone number is 212-209-2900. We are taking your calls, not about drumming, but of course we could talk about drumming because, you know, a family is like a band. Everybody plays a part. You have a piano and a bass and a trumpet and a, you know, trombone and drums. And if, you know, so now this is the way your family sounds. They sound like a band or they sound like an orchestra. And you take out one thing. You take out one thing and you go, oh, you know, the trumpet's no longer here. Oh, it's all right. We can get along with just the piano, the bass, and the... And then you have something like, you know, the mom and the pop. They're probably the bass and the drums. Because if you take out the drums and you have no rhythm, then you got to leave it up to the bass to do the entire rhythm. Right? But then if you take away the bass, now you have no rhythm. You know, it's almost impossible to play drums without a bass. So it's like you got to have each part of the family. And you have to have each part, and each part has to be in some kind of harmony. Now, let's say you had somebody who was a weak trumpet player, but he wanted to play trumpet, and he was a weak trumpet player. I remember when I grew up with some jazz musicians, there was a very famous tenor saxophonist who I won't mention because his brother was a really, really poor trumpet player. But he wanted to help his brother out, so he put his brother on all of his albums. And he became very, very famous saxophonist, and his brother was never very good. His brother on his own never stood out. But he became very famous, but he brought his brother along, and here he had, in this interplay of music, you would always hear him playing with his weaker brother, and the way he would play to his brother's strengths that were very minor, and it became part of the band, and it's the way the band sounded. So that finally, when the brother was removed from the band for a recording thing, the brother, the great one, couldn't play as well. Because he was dependent on his brother who didn't play well. You know what I mean? So you play good, and you play good to compensate for your bad brother who doesn't play well, and then you remove the bad brother, you think the band is going to get better? No. No, you lost your spirit. I'm sure you'll find an analogy of that somewhere in your life. 212-209-2900. This is Armand DeMille. Let me take one of your calls. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, Armand.
Hello there.
Hi, nice to talk to you.
Nice to talk to you. What's your name?
Catherine.
Hello, Catherine.
So, wow, this is really cool. So many things are swimming around my mind from, you know, such a rich fabric of thoughts you put out here. My gosh. Two things are coming to mind for me. One is about the friendship, and maybe they tie together, is that I don't know if I'm unique, but I think I'm sort of odd in that I don't have any friends. So that's like one thing. And the other thing I wanted to address is the family system thing, how once our kids have left home, how that really, and they've been gone a while now, and the more on their own they get, the more odd it is for my husband and myself. We're still together, but when you talk about removing pieces of the chess game and, you know, what's left, it becomes entirely strange, I guess. It's like you're floundering uncharted waters.
How many children did you have, Catherine?
Two.
Two children who grew up and moved out of the house?
Yes.
Wow. And then, now that's quite an accomplishment as it is, but then it became there the focus. Now, who was your favorite, your son or your daughter?
I can't believe I'm
You're
going to
say your son.
Yes.
Right. And who's your husband's favorite?
It's hard to tell. My daughter was a lot like him,
Okay, so there we have it. And so there you have the triangulation of a family. right? And now you have the triangulation of a family of two triangles. And now you take off the bottom end of two triangles, and you have something that looks like half an isosceles rectangle.
Yeah, right.
It looks like a funny hexagonal or something like that.
Yeah.
And it has no place to tie.
Yeah.
So you should adopt the child.
Yeah, right. Yeah, I'm not in the mood.
Fill in that gap. Let me take you back to when you were a kid.
All right.
No friends, right? How did you feel? Did you have any brothers and sisters when you were a kid?
Yeah, I did have brothers.
And how was your, you're the only woman?
Yeah, well,
you're the only
girl
in the family?
A sister came along when I was 16, a stepsister, so I don't know if that even
counts. She doesn't count.
Yeah.
So you grew up, well, if there's 7 years difference, it doesn't count. I mean, it counts, but it doesn't count in the dynamics as much.
Mm-hmm.
So there you grew up, and you grew up as the only girl.
Mm-hmm.
Now you had a choice. You were either going to become a boy,
mm-hmm.
or you're going to be alone.
Mm-hmm.
What did you do?
A little of both. I became
That's
a tomboy,
right.
And I spent most of my time alone.
So how did you get along with people who you would consider girly girls?
I just looked at them with disdain, like, please.
Right, and you call them, and I'm not paraphrasing the governor of California, but if I say the word girly girls to you, you know what I mean.
Yeah, I do. I think I do, yeah.
So you're alienated from that part of yourself.
Yeah, I guess maybe I am.
Yeah. Now, does anything ever activate that part of yourself? The part of that thing that you disdain so much, which is that feeling of, you know, being not as strong as the boys and being powerless sometimes and...
Does anything activate that?
Yeah, did love, romance ever make you feel like you could relax and surrender?
Yeah, it did a bit. And when I did that, my husband really hated it.
So you got a contract with your husband, and the deal with your husband was, I'll be a boy for you. I'll be strong for you. That's your deal with your husband.
Well, after so many years, but that's sort of the way that's the drama I've played. I guess that's true.
Uh-huh. So yeah. How does he feel about the marriage at this point?
I'm afraid to bring it up because I don't feel like opening myself up for the potential onslaught that might follow, but I think he's just happy to have his space and to work on the stuff he enjoys, and then we, you know, get together and spend time together occasionally and enjoy that. But most of the time, we both have, like, our independent projects and lives. And
your roommates?
Yeah.
With benefits or without benefits?
Lately, the benefits have not really been there, except, you know, like, talking benefits, going places together occasionally.
But
benefits.
No having sex?
That's sort of, like, been waning.
Yeah. So, you know, what you're seeing is what happens naturally, especially with empty nest. What happens is both birds in the empty nest, both adult birds go settle into their own spot, and they're no longer related to each other. They're no longer juicing each other up. They're no longer sparking each other. And it's such a common thing to happen. And it's just like, you know, you kind of build your own life and you wait to die.
Oh, I'm not waiting to die. I'm having a very good time.
You're having a party on the outside.
Well, I mean, you know, I'm not seeing other guys, that kind of party, but I have a lot of interests, and I'm, you know, I'm enjoying the freedom and the time that I didn't have so much before, and I'm really, you know, I'm having a good time waiting to die. I'm hoping for as many years as possible, actually.
Well, let's go back a little bit now with your husband. You think there's any chance that it could be revived?
There is, but I'm not sure. This is going to sound preposterous, maybe, but I'm not even sure I want to.
Absolutely. I understand completely.
Because then I'm going to have to compromise. Then he's going to want to go do X, but I really want to do Y. And I'm tired of putting off what I want to do.
You want to rule your roost. You want to be the one who's in charge. You want to be in charge of your life. And you don't want to have any of these negotiations or sharing of anything, because sharing has never done anything good for you.
Right, sharing, there's no, I mean, basically, no. I mean, maybe that's why I don't have friends. I just see it that,
Exactly.
It's going to be a taking thing, a giving thing. You know, I'm going to have to give, and what I'm going to get back, who knows, crumbs maybe. I mean, I know this sounds crazy.
No, I know what you're saying, Catherine, because what it suggests is that you're a person who perceives meager resources. You see, you don't see that there are abundant resources out there. You see that they're meager. And when you see them as meager, you say, I've got to hold my own, and I don't have any to spare. That's usually the perception of somebody who's been depressed most of their life.
Well, I was depressed a lot of my life till I got myself out of it about 15 years ago.
Yeah, and the habit of that depression is still with you. Because that's the way it works, and I understand completely what you're saying, and you've got my heart, and I hear that you're going to run your life the way you are, but I'm also going to say to you, you're missing a piece.
Well, like what? What am I missing?
Well, first of all, to give your friend, who happens to have been the one who brought up your children with you, a shot at some kind of joyful life, and yourself with it. There's a thing there, you know, there's a romance that's somewhere available. And it's worth at least a shot, not to shake up the system, not to negotiate, not to give away your nights out, not to do things like that. But there's a way of keeping things alive and sparked, but you don't know it because you're functioning from meager resources. You see what I mean? And that's the idea of having no friends. You have no friends because you don't have resources to spare, but it's not true. You got plenty of resources to spare. You just don't know it.
Use another word for resources.
Energy.
Oh, energy. Wow.
Yeah, that said it all there.
That's interesting. I never thought about it the way you're making it come out.
Sure. Depressed people always perceive energy as a resource.
Yeah, well, I think I do. I think I do.
Yeah, and you got much more than you think. And it's much more abundant than you think, but it's been masked. You know, you haven't been aware of it. So we've got a spot for you to dance to yet, a place for you to get into this world and join it. You know, there's another place for you. And I know there are 100 women listening to you on the phone right now who wish they could be your friend. Because you talk with such honesty, and you talk from such a centered place. But what they don't know is you wouldn't want them because you'd think you have to put out too much, you know? Thanks for calling in.
Thank you so much.
Sure, Catherine.
Bye.
Bye. 212-209-2900. This is Armand DeMille. We're talking about family systems theory, about how we repeat some of the patterns from our childhood, how they come up and bite us in the butt when we're not looking. 212-209-2900. Let's take another call. Hi, this is Armand DeMille. You're on the air.
How you doing?
Good.
Armand DeMille?
Yes.
Good. Okay, great. Now, you hit it right on the nose. I like to show, first of all, like WBI altogether.
Could you speak just a little louder?
Okay, I will.
You have a very nice voice.
Thank you. Some people tell me that.
I'm sure.
I'm having a battle with my brother. He's the only family member that lives in the house. We have a house in Jersey. And like what happens that my nieces and my nephews, which is his children, I don't understand. And I would rate it as that's dysfunctional. Like what happens is that I'm...
Well, what happens exactly? What's your name, by the way?
James Gallian.
Hey, James. What happens specifically with your family that you don't understand?
Oh, they're young adults, so they're wild. The young adults, they're wild. And, like, my brother, he's been to college, he's been to the military, he had government jobs. He's smarter than I am, but he doesn't look it. He doesn't take care of himself. It's kind of a disgrace. And, like, you saying about me getting along with my family, if I leave the family behind, which I have been doing, I feel grief, which is true.
So, James, you are the older son?
I'm the youngest. I'm the youngest of my mother's kid, my mother and father's kid.
And so now your brother is doesn't take care of himself. He doesn't take care of his children. He's kind of just like barely there. And you get angry because you want him to be better than he is.
Yes. I
mean, and haven't you always felt that way about him?
He takes care of his children, but like he wastes his money on his children on things they don't need. He doesn't take care of himself.
Yeah, and so what you're doing is you're saying that you have become your brother's father. You suddenly decided to become your brother's teacher. You judge him. You judge how he takes care of his children. You see what he's doing, that it's a mistake, and it doesn't take, you know, in your wisdom, I'm sure you're right. But you have become your brother's father.
And this awkward
now, when that happens, what I have to describe is when someone sits in judgment of their sibling, the sibling reacts to them as if they are a parent, and the sibling resents them. And your brother is going to resent the way you talk to him about him and about his children because you're going to keep preaching at him. You got to stop preaching, James.
Yes.
You know you have to stop preaching.
Yes, somebody else told me the same thing.
How do you like that? There are two smart people in the world. Hey, James, you got to stop preaching, and one of the ways that when you stop preaching, you begin loving something exactly the way it is. Now, I know you have experience with this in your life. Tell me what your hobby is.
Being an activist.
You're an activist, right? Now, when you're an activist and you're going out there and you see a system that's falling apart, did you ever look at the system and say, before I try to change anything, I'm going to have to understand it, I'm going to have to be in it, and I'm going to have to love it the way it is before I try to change it? Or if you just get in there and you start fighting, what do you do first?
I get in there and start fighting.
And that's why it doesn't work. You see, you know, you probably know Susanna, who works with me.
Huh?
Susanna Ross, do you know her?
No.
Okay, she's an activist, and she works with me here at the DeMille Center. She works by always, she's a great psychologist, and she works by getting in to understand the system that she's working with first. And then when she really understands it so that she could feel it from their point of view, then she initiates change from the inside, and those are the most effective changers. Not saying that we don't need the people who protest and scream and yell, but we do need the people who understand and are loving first, because compassion gets you a picture of what the other person is feeling. You need to find what your brother's heart is like without judging him. And I tell you, things will change. And things will change with you. Don't become your father, that you was never there, you know? Don't become that.
Okay.
James, thank you for calling in.
Thank you.
212-209-2900. This is Armand DeMille. So James points up another thing. Sometimes when there is an absent member of a family in a family system, when there's not a father, one of the children will play the role of the father or play the role of the mother, you know, when the mother is absent. If the mother's absent to illness, sometimes mothers are absent to, like, emotional illness, fathers too. The child fills that in. 212-209-2900. Take another call. Hi, you're on the air. This is Armand DeMille.
Hi, Armand.
Hi there.
My name is Linda.
Hello, Linda.
I just wanted to talk about friendship.
Sure.
I don't have any brothers in the house. You know, no brothers. We're all sisters. And throughout my childhood and up to the adulthood, I've been always had male friends more than female friends. Much more comfortable with males.
Sure.
And, you know, having a great time with them, talk, chat. But
I'll tell you this much, Linda, that part of the problem you have with Linda, with women, is that you think women get jealous of you, don't you?
That's absolutely it.
Absolutely, right? Your perception is, I don't like women because they get jealous of me.
Yeah.
Therefore, I hang out with men.
Because it seems too boring. My nails, it's about the hair, if it is not about
it's not about that. It's about that you believe that you, being an attractive person, as I'm sure you are, Linda, have attracted men, and that girls get angry at you. and women get angry at you, and you believe they're jealous of you. Now, you know, you didn't have to say much to me, but all you had to do is say my name is Linda, and I knew it. You know, now I'm going to take it one step further. Not because I know you, Linda, but because I could hear it in your voice. When you were a child, there were all the girls around you, right?
Yep.
Where was your father?
In the house.
Who was close to him?
I was in a very strange way.
In what strange way?
Always protected him, even though I was not really talking to him or sharing things with him.
Right, but you were daddy's girl.
Yeah, I was always there for him.
Always there for him, even though your sisters weren't.
Yeah.
And your mother wasn't.
Yeah.
So you were alienated. You were not. You were allied with your father, male, and not allied with the girls. And the girls, your sisters, they must have been jealous of you. And they had to be jealous because you got at least some kind of connection with Dad. And so they were jealous. Mom must have gotten jealous of you. And so you grow up believing that everybody gets jealous of you because of the one sin that you committed in your life, which is that you loved your father when nobody else would. Powerful words, isn't it, Linda?
Oh, you're killing me.
I don't mean to kill you. I want to invite you back to life. You know, you get down underneath it, you learn about it, you learn about yourself, you move on. Because, you know, I'm going to say something, you have to have members of the same sex as friends. You have to. It's part of your tribe. You know, it's part of your world. You have to have friends of the same sex, otherwise you're doomed.
No, I do have a lot of friends, but I'm not really close to them.
Yeah, you know what I mean. Yeah. Best friends, right. Best friends. Right. We're going to have to go. I want to thank you for calling. Listen, thank you for calling in. Thank you for being so brave.
Okay.
Remember, volunteer psych, social worker, or anybody, call my office, 212-757-4488, 212-757-4488. Once again, you're listening to the music of Eric Alabaster doing some Calypso. And I'll be back with you tomorrow at 1 p.m., my friends, bringing you more exciting information stuff. The website, thepositivemind.com.
This is Evelyn Andino Rosa, Subscriptions Director for WBAI, with an important announcement for people making donations to the station. Please make sure to use the enclosed envelopes received with your invoices. These envelopes contain our current banking address. That address is Pacifica Foundation, WBAI Radio, General Post Office, P.O. Box 30540, New York, New York, 10087-0540. Again, for those who are fulfilling your pledges through the mail, make sure to use the enclosed envelopes provided. For those who wish to mail in their donations without an invoice, please use the same address. If you need more information, please call us at 212-209-2800. That's 212-209-2800. Another reminder from WBAI, your peace and justice station.
Wow, that was some dinner.
What do you want to do now?
Well, let's go through those bills.
You want to pay bills?
Well, who said pay them? I said go through them.
Oh, okay.
Okay. Gas and electric sent us another bill.
The food processor will take care of that. It's electric.
Right. Well, here's a bill from the phone company.
Who needs them? A tin can and some string works just as well.
Well, good thing we have a garbage disposal.
That's what I say. Ooh, here's a bill from WBAI.
Oh, good. Let me show you what I learned in origami class.
No, we want to pay this bill.
We do?
Yes.
But I can turn it into a paper swan.
We don't need a paper swan.
We don't?
We made a pledge to WBAI.
Well, sure. We're devoted listeners.
Devoted listeners pay their pledges to WBAI to keep WBAI on the air.
I agree.
Good.
But I really want to show you my paper swan.
Fine. Here's the bill from your psychiatrist.
We're having a party.
This is Dale Ratner, your local election supervisor. The August 31st deadline for the election is coming up fast. If you want to vote or run as a candidate, you must contribute at least $25 by that date. There will also be a membership party on August 31st at 5:30 p.m. at WBAI, 120 Wall Street, 10th floor. You can donate your $25, pick up a candidate packet, and get signatures on your petition. Again, the party will be Friday, August 31st at 5:30 p.m. at WBAI, 120 Wall Street, 10th floor. Have a question or concern? Email me at votewbai@gmail.com. I hope to see you at the party. Everybody's